From the Office of Student Research at Roosevelt University, this is The Theory Club. All right, Emily, how you doing?
I'm doing well, for once. Sure, people can relate to that.
Fabulous. Yes, listeners, welcome to this episode of The Theory Club. Today, we are going to talk about Suzanne Cusick's piece in Queering the Pit, the new gay and lesbian musicology book, and it's chapter 4 in there called On a Lesbian Relationship with Music. I have so much to say about this chapter. It's one of my favorite musicology things that I've ever read, so I'm really excited to dig into it. Before we do that, we need to address what has happened. There has been...
I was waiting for that.
I know. Listen, listeners. There has been, in the Theory Club lore, a breach in insecurity. It's been insane. So, Emily, if you want to just articulate for the listeners what happened yesterday, because I came to my phone in a panic. There were several texts. I was like, what's happening with Emily? What's going on? So please enlighten us.
Okay, so there is a Facebook group for like classical musicians or whatever, and I've just been a part of it for a while. There's like 40,000 people in this group too. A lot of like my friends too are in it. Like it's a very well-known group. And someone made a post asking for anyone in the group to drop their favorite classical music podcasts or anything related to that. So I was like, oh, I'll drop the Theory Club. You know, it's a bit different. Let's see, you know, people might like it, check it out. So I did, and other people were putting theirs down as well. And, you know, we got some nice comments saying, oh, this sounds interesting and can't wait to listen to it, following on Spotify. Yeah, all that nice stuff. And then there was one not so nice comment. I won't say the name, even though I want to. He was blocked from the group anyway. But okay. The first comment was, just had a quick look. Seems like it's obsessed with skin color. No thanks. And so I was kind of in shock when I first read this. I didn't go to Lydia right away because I was like, you know what? I could probably handle this like in a calm, collected way.
Which I appreciate. Thank you.
So I kindly responded, unfortunately, there's a lot of racism in the field of classical music, so it has to be a part of the conversation. And this guy still comes back with, give me some examples. And at that point, I was like yelling at my phone. And this one other guy that was like kind of standing up for us put like this like meme of, who's that guy? Do you know that guy? Like, his name from a TV show?
Oh, Mr. Bean.
Yeah, like dancing in the mirror. I don't know. I think he was making fun of him.
Right.
And then, yeah, like literally if you're asking for, that's what the thing was where I was like, you're asking for examples of racism in classical music, but you refuse to like listen to the podcast or check it out because it has something to do with that. So I'm like, if you take the time to listen to the episodes on our podcast that address those issues, you would know. And then it got worse from there, long story short. So as soon as they got out of hand and it turned to almost like an argument, I had to reach out to the admin of the group and report his comments. And luckily it took them about half an hour to get on and see it, but they commented back goodbye to him, like to the admin, just put goodbye and removed him from the group. So he is not in the group.
Yes. And I mean, thank you, Emily, for handling that situation. For the listener, Emily, you know, kind of runs all of our social media stuff. So she runs the Instagram and the Facebook page and all the things. So because I am without social media, I do not have a Facebook or a Twitter or an Instagram. So, you know, I wouldn't have seen a comment like that, or, you know, I don't interact with the internet in that way for precisely this reason, because it's a bit of a hellhole, right? We know, we've been new. Here's the thing, okay, not me ranting about this, but I am gonna rant. You know, I have to, you know,
go for it.
And it's because It's because, okay, so this person, right? Like, we just need to break this down. This person is, coming at Emily saying, classical music isn't racist, right? Like, oh, you guys only care about skin color, and we shouldn't be talking about classical music in relation to race because they don't have anything to do with each other, right?
Yeah, and I have to jump in really quickly to that because what's funny too? I'm not going to say exactly what he said, but right, you made that point. And then afterwards, his next comments were about religion and politics. And I was like, what does that have to do with anything that we were just talking about?
Right? So it's like, okay, so those things can be connected to classical music, but race can't, or gender can't, right? Or sexuality can't. Like, it's just really strange, right? It's strange to me. And the thing about that is, right, if you're a white person and you're gonna come up to me and you're gonna talk about how there are spaces in American life and politics that are devoid of the legacy and impact of white supremacy, you're gonna come and talk to me about how there are spaces that are free of white. Like, that's just not true. And just because we're in, just because we're in the same room, me and a white person are in the same room, and there's something that happens, right, that is a result of these larger systems of oppression, right? There's a microaggression that happens or whatever, and because that white person didn't recognize it, it doesn't mean it didn't happen, right? Like, so just because you're like, well, we were in the same room and nothing racist happened there, it's like, I'm sorry, sir, you're actually not equipped to comment on that, are you? Like, you wouldn't know. So it's like, I don't. Lydia's just getting upset over nothing. I didn't see any racism. It's like, okay, I didn't ask you. I'm sorry, sir. You've got to go. And it, again, also notice that the people who make comments like that, people that are like, wow, it's just so hard to listen to Black people talk about race all the time, right? Black people are so triggered. Women are so triggered. They just won't stop talking about the patriarchy. Like, I can't even make a joke anymore. Comedy is dead. You can't go on the internet without somebody attacking you because you didn't use the like politically correct term. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. You know what's harder than being a white person and having to listen to Black people talk about race, or Black people say Black Lives Matter, or worry about being canceled because you misgendered somebody or you used a politically incorrect term? You know what's worse than all of that? Racism. I'm sorry. It's just like, oh, I just gotta hear these people talk about it again. Like, white supremacy, we get it. Yeah. You do to listen to us talk about it again because it sucks for a lot of people. It sucks for everybody, right? But in different ways and to varying degrees. And if you don't want to be a part of that conversation, then you're part of the problem, sir. Like, that's just, there's just no other way to say it. Anyway, let me stop ranting about that. Dear listener, if you have been listening to this podcast and you're like, dang, I just hate that god-awful podcast, I'm gonna send some hate mail. Don't. You don't
Just
have to
don't
do
listen
that.
to
Yeah, just don't listen to
I'm
it.
saying,
If you
wait, but
send
when
a
I read,
nasty, mm-mm.
I was gonna say, like, when I read that comment, it's like, okay, now that it's good to have that thought process, but even if you do, if you look at it and you're like, okay, they talk about racism, I don't really want to listen to that. Don't comment it, just don't listen to it. Like, they blew that whole
Yeah.
thing way out of proportion.
Right? It's like,
Like,
listen, if you hate the podcast, you just don't have to tell us. If you send us a bad comment or a nasty email, I will roast you on the pod. I want all y'all listeners to, I will roast you. I will make sure that it gets trending on Twitter. You will be mercilessly memed for 72 hours on Twitter. Don't do it. Don't do it. Keep your nasty comments to yourself. If you have a nice comment and you want to counteract that man's aggression, you can send it to thetheoryclubpodcast@gmail.com. Much appreciated. So
yeah, I was very happy though. I was like this close to wanting to actually just leave the group entirely just because it was such a negative experience. Just even that one thing, I was just like, I was about to leave, but I was really happy with the way that the admin handled it because realistically, they let anyone in. I think you have to answer a few questions to be accepted, but they let you in the group. And then that can happen, you know? So I'm glad that at least they did everything in their power once it happened to get it down, get him out of the group. And that they also liked their link and stuff. So I was very happy that they're supporting it.
That is really nice. We appreciate it. We appreciate those admins doing the Lord's work. We love it.
This could go at the beginning or end, but I feel like it's interesting to kind of add in since season two is focused on females and women kind of in music. On our Facebook group page, and I asked when people encountered music written by female composers in their music career. And I mean, the outcome was kind of what I expected. Yeah, so no one encountered music written by a female composer in beginning to a year of being in music. Only one person did between 1 to 2 years already in music. And then 20% in 2 to 4 years of already playing. And then 80% were 5+ years where they finally encountered some piece of music written by a female composer. So, if you're not in the group, now you know at least that's so far, you know, a great example of, and I think that was a good realization moment, even in the comments, what some people wrote, saying, wow, didn't realize that, or coming to realize. I've kind of recognized that we've talked about more, how certain composers or composers of color or women aren't recognized, and I still don't realize that some people don't realize that yet. So it was interesting to see kind of the group on Facebook participate in that poll. Yeah.
Out of my system. We need to talk about this piece. So again, it's the fourth chapter in the new gay and lesbian musicology book called Queer in the Pitch. The chapter is called On a Lesbian Relationship with Music and a Serious Effort Not to Think Straight. And it's by Suzanne Cusick. I first read this piece when I was in a class with Dr. Care, shout out to Dr. Care, beloved friend of the pod. I remember us doing a unit on embodiment, and that's when we read Boccherini's Body by Elizabeth Le Guin, which is another really, really cool musicology piece. And then reading this. And I... What happened at the time is I remember reading this and thinking, whoa, I'm into this. I think this is really interesting and has given me a lot of new thoughts about music. And I remember I had to write a reflection on this piece for class. And so I wrote in my paper thing, I really resonate with the way that Cusick is talking about music here. I feel this way when I'm performing, right? That I have almost this romantic relationship with music and with performance. And as I was writing this paper, I was like, I also feel this way, right? Feel this bond and emotional attachment to theory. And I remember writing that. And I was like, whoa, that was a lot. Hold on. I was like, wait, do I actually feel that way? And I turned in the paper. And, the next day I got an email from Dr. Care. And he's like, you need to come to my office. And I was like, oh, no.
Oh, no.
it was too racy for Dr. Kerr. I didn't mean it. And then, you know, I go to his office and he's like, so you like theory? And I was like, yeah, I was like, I guess. Keep in mind, this was all, you know, this was in like February 2020. So it's like right before Corona is really about to hit the US. And I was not yet a tutor for music theory. I was not yet the TA. I was not really thinking about theory at all, which is why Dr. Kerr called me into his office, because he was like, I didn't know you felt that way about theory. And I was like, I also didn't know that I felt that way. And so, you know, then things kind of kicked off from there, because that was when he suggested that I do a research project centered around music theory. And then we got the grant money, and then that was and the rest is history, my love affair with music theory. This piece really changed a lot for me, because it changed the way that I thought about performance and the way that I thought about theory, and made a lot of things in retrospect make a lot of sense. Emily, do you have any opening thoughts before I kind of give an overview of what this piece is about, and then we'll get into it?
Well, my initial thoughts were kind of like any freshman's initial thoughts, I guess. I love the subtitles. They just made me laugh so much, like the who's on top, what if music is sex? I'm reading it and I'm just like laughing whenever I get to this. I don't know. I thought it was funny. And yeah, the first time I read it, I don't think I analyzed as deeply as the second time I read it. It made a lot more sense to me. But that was just my initial thoughts. And during that time, that was like prime injury time to me. And this was actually the first article that Lydia recommended to me out of many. And when I, reading this one as the first one, I was very excited. And this was new to me, because really I never read any articles related to music, like musicology or anything like that in high school, even though I did get a bit into theory. So yeah, this was very new. And I remember just being so excited, like placing time out of my day. I'm like, okay, after this class, I'm going to read the article. And I was just so excited. So yeah, I think it's very interesting, but we can get a bit more into what it actually consists of.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So a bit of an overview for the listener. Cusick begins off the piece kind of talking about how she is experiencing a lot of fear and nervousness around connecting her sexuality and musicality, but she ultimately feels like her sexuality, and she identifies as a lesbian, that it can't be separated from her musicality, and poses the question, you know, can musicality be a sexuality, meaning having like a deeper relationship with music that kind of mimics the same feelings, like bodily visceral responses and reactions, right? The same give and take that you feel in a relationship with a partner. So it's kind of like, what can music be, a partner of sorts? And what would that mean? And how does that affect music making? How does that affect music pedagogy? So it's a really, really interesting endeavor that she embarks on, which was so hardy for any time, but especially, you know, she wrote this in the 90s. So you can imagine it making quite a splash in the 90s when it came out, as opposed to, you know, maybe if it came out in 2021, it might be a bit better received. But I imagine that she received a fair amount of criticism for this type of feminist musicology. So I remember when we were in class and we were discussing the piece, a lot of my colleagues were really uncomfortable. Like, they were like, this does not make any sense. I feel, particularly the men in the room, they're like, I don't know, I reread this. This is too much for me, right? And so did you feel any of that discomfort? Because I honestly did not, right? Like, it definitely made me blush, but it was like not, I was like all in.
You know, yeah, no, I feel like you have to be on like a different level of intelligence to like actually understand. I feel like if there were like people in that class that were just like, I don't want to say not as, like not as emotionally involved, like in music maybe, and not as like totally, I don't know how to word this.
Right. Am
I
making any sense? Like you said, there is some, the way that we think about classical music as this kind of white, sterile, like, right? We not only do some people associate it with being devoid of race, some people associate it with being devoid of sex, right? That it's this mm-hmm. this genre that's removed from sexuality, right? Because it's proper and elite and right, like
right.
Which is just not true in a lot of different ways, right? Because there's definitely classical music about sex. First of all,
literally, it probably like we don't know exactly what the composer wrote them about, especially I'm feeling some composers like reading about them.
Yes,
that's probably what it's about. But it's like
instances we know exactly what they were writing about, right? Opera is full of sex, I will say that. And so, like, so one, that's just like not true. So if you're somebody who chooses to see classical music as completely removed from sexuality, that is a choice that you're making. Mm-hmm. And not,
I feel like if I were to mm-hmm. if I were to like just generally talk like or say classical music like around one of my like non-music friends like from high school, they would just think of like a bunch of white men in like fancy suits like
right
drinking tea with their pinkies up or something, like something like so serious, like you don't
right
really, you know, especially people outside of classical music and even some in it still think like that it's such a proper and serious thing when
right
really it could be like it is practically all in the music.
Right. I would be interested to read, I don't know, maybe I'll find something for us to look at later, but I would be interested to read musics or instruments that we do associate with sex. Like people regard like the saxophone as like a sexy instrument, like why?
Yeah.
Like is jazz like a sexy genre? Is it because it's a black genre? Is it right? Like I would be interested to know really what makes the saxophone sexy. Like what about that is like, why do we not regard like the vibraphone as also sexy? I don't know, right? So it's that's an interesting piece of musicology. And somebody, if you've read something about that, send it to us, the Theory Club Podcast at gmail.com. We want to read it. So yeah, there's never been a time that I've read this and I've reread it a lot where I was like, ooh, this is weird. Like it always made so much sense to me, and I think it's because like I resonate so much so strongly with Cusick's ideas and defining sexuality in this way. So okay, yeah, so let's start there. This is interesting because she has a section where she talks about sexuality and musicality and proposes a definition of, okay, if we're going to have a conversation about sexuality and music, we need to define what sexuality is, right? So most people would associate it with like sexual orientation, meaning you are straight or gay or lesbian, queer, right? So in an identity, or not an identity, but an orientation. And what she wants to pull it towards is an identity, and not tie it to this person loves women or this person loves men. Tie it to, she proposes this definition, quote, "It is a way of expressing and or enacting relationships of intimacy through physical pleasure, shared, accepted, forgiven." So by that definition, what can be perceived then as sexual, right? Who can you interact with where there's give and take, where there's physical pleasure shared, accepted, or given, right? And by that definition, it's a pretty expansive way to think about sexuality and what, who and or what you can, right, have an intimate relationship with, right? So by that definition, then she later on says that our sexual identity might be more musician than it is lesbian, gay, or straight. And I remember reading that and I was like, that's it. Like, that's the, because like I, again, oof, for the listener, I don't know how personal we're trying to get, but I, you know, men are cool. I just think that I've always felt more drawn to music than I do to most relationships, right? Like, than I do.
That's to, interesting.
Right? The whole, than I do to the whole concept and institution of marriage, than I do to like most people. Like, I just fit with music in a way that I don't know that I fit with the way that we have imagined and the way that we perform heteronormativity. Does that make sense?
Yeah. What's interesting for me, it's kind of, I don't want to say it's backwards to what you said, but it's like, I feel like music draws me to men. Like the way I feel when I listen to music and the way I feel when I listen to music and play music, kind of like the experiences and the feelings I get with that make, geez, this is hard. It's there. It's just not in like words. It's in Emily language right now. I'm just trying to like translate. But it's kind of like backwards from what you said. I just kind of lost it.
No, I'm picking up what you're putting down. So
okay.
If I'm interpreting this correctly, you know, it's a way that you cement a bond with a person, right? Like it's a way that you are attracted to and then follow through on that attraction to another person, right? Like if they're really passionate about music or they're a musician, then that is attractive to you, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like that I feel like that even makes it like the bond stronger, just because I have so many like of those like experiences, like she talks about in the article, when I'm like performing music or listening to it. So if I know there's someone else that can relate to that, I feel like that makes like the bond between us even closer and more likely to be like an actual relationship or soulmate, in our words from earlier.
Sure. I mean, this is interesting because I used to talk about this with my music major friends, like during my undergrad, like whether you needed to be in a relationship with another musician or whether you didn't want that. And I always used to fall in the camp of, I don't want to marry another musician. That would feel like I would never get a space to not be a musician. Like that would feel... Like I remember, you know, during my undergrad, there was a year that one of my roommates was a geology major, and it was really nice to just come home to my like geology roommate and not have to deal with like the drama of the music building, right? Like there were, you know, houses and apartments that I got invited to where people were like, come live with us, Lydia. Oh, this will be so fun, right? Like all of us music majors living together. And I remember being like, this is not about to, no. Right, like because you know you come home and it's always there and you're always talking about music or you're always, you know, discussing it, or again just being around the same people all the time. When you're in the music program, you're already spending all your time together, like in rehearsals, in class, like you see them all the time, and then I gotta go home and you're there and then you're gonna know my business. And they're going to tell everybody in the music program, they have some mess. Okay. And I was not about to be in the mess. So it was really nice to come home to my like geology roommate who was like removed from all that. And, you know, we didn't talk about music because as much as I identify so strongly with being a musician, I'm not only a musician, And it was nice to have a space where I wasn't. That's not true, Emily. You have multiple identities, right? That, you know, strongly have to do with musicianship, but you exist in other facets.
Right. I could see that. Like, I would want to be with a musician 100%, but I mean, I also say you really can't help who you fall in love with. Sometimes I just fell in love with some interesting creatures out there, but I would hope that I would not be with another violinist, because it's just a bit too much like competitiveness. I feel so, there's still a sense of like competition in me that I'm trying to like erase, that I've like learned, like unlearned some like competitive feelings from violin. But I couldn't see myself being with another violinist. That to me is exactly what you're describing. That's what it would be for me. But another musician, like someone, literally just any other instrument, or someone who's into theory or like anything music related, amazing. We'll like fall asleep talking about 5-7 chords or something. I don't know. Like that's the dream for me.
Wow. Oh my God. And you have these pet names that are like, good night, my little German on your sixth chord.
No, that's what I was just gonna say. I was just thinking of three cats and three augmented six chords, like the French, Italian, German. I'm learning about that now.
Wow. All right. Listener, if you're listening and you're, you know, a sophomore male and you're a musician, email us at thetheoryclubpodcast.com. Send in your resumes for Emily to peruse.
Yes, you have to like augmented six chords in order to send in your resume, but please do. It will be reviewed by the one and only.
Oh my God.
Matt, this took a fun turn.
So let's talk about this, because I wrote in my reflection, like, I get this feeling, like this physical sensation in my body when I'm doing analysis and I'm looking at a score and I find something really cool, right? Or there's a part that I always listen to and, you know, it always really stood out to me, like, oh, that's a really interesting passage, or, oh, I don't understand what's happening there. And then I look in the score and there's like, there is an ecstasy, right, that is released in my brain when I'm looking at the score and I figure it out. And it's this moment of like, yes, we did it, right? That moment, right, is like similar to what she talks about in this piece, right? Having these moments of like listening to music and there's just like the perfect cadence or the perfect whatever, right? Like something that speaks volumes to you as a listener, and you just have this moment, right, like wash over you, right? That's the argument that she's making. Ultimately, are those so unlike a sexual encounter or experience? Are they? Right, like it's, the lines are blurry. That's all she's trying to say, is that the lines are blurry. And I really agree with that, right? I have these moments during listening. I have these moments during singing. And I have these moments during analysis, which I think is so interesting. That's what really launched me on my first pedagogy project, was how come we're in the same class experiencing the same pedagogy, right? We're experiencing the same teaching, we're doing the same homework, we're learning the same concepts, and I'm having these moments of pure delight and joy and discovery, and my classmates are like hating it, right? Like, where is that that disconnect happening? And like, let's explore that. So that is what my project ended up really turning into. But yeah, she just makes this argument She says, quote, if music isn't sexuality, for most of us, it is psychically right next door, right? Like the physical, visceral reactions in your body, are they really all that unlike a sexual experience? Like, yes and no, right? Yeah. Like,
I thought it was interesting. This is where she gets into my favorite subtitle, Who's on Top? And she explains, like, how, okay, so, like, even you can have, take me, for example, like, okay, I'm a violinist, so, like, I perform music, and I'm also a teacher, so, like, I teach music, and then I also enjoy music theory, kind of, like, on the side, I do that still, and so, like, I like kind of analyzing music and, like, doing, like, oral skill stuff, but when she kind of says, like, when she performs music, she's like on the bottom, like music is doing it to her, music is what makes her feel that way, but then when she's the teacher, she's on top, like she's the one that's allowing it to happen, you know, to her students to feel that joy when they're learning music or playing music. And then I don't think she said anything about theory in this part, but then for me it'd be like, I feel like I'd be on the bottom for theory. But you know, like I thought that was really interesting, like the way she like put that wording in and trying to like make me analyze basically different types of music related things that I do, like how does music affect me in what way. That was one thing I really liked.
Sure, yeah, that's really interesting. She has, yes, like Emily said, this section where she talks about teaching her students. I believe she's a keyboardist, like an organ player, and she apparently, I don't know if this is literal or if she just used this as an example. I would love to see like a masterclass of this happening, if this was like a literal thing that she does with her students. She said in the piece that she has her students like lie down on their backs, and that her male students in particular are quite uncomfortable with this. And, you know, she plays the music, maybe like she plays it on the organ, or she, you know, lets the music play like a recording or whatever, and she asked the students to just simply let it happen to them, right? To notice the physical sensations in their body without any sort of analysis, without trying to pick apart what's happening, just to simply let it happen, let it wash over you. She literally says to let the music quote unquote do it to them, and then you go back and you say, okay, what did you feel, how did it make you feel, where did it make you feel, and then let's talk about that, and let's come up with an analysis to explain that, to complement that, right? So I think this is really interesting, this idea of let's let the feelings and the emotions happen, the reactions happen, before we let the analysis happen. Does that perhaps keep the analysis from becoming like really dry and devoid of this, you know, passion that music really affords us? Kind of this whole idea of once you study something, it becomes not as fun, like it loses the magic or the spark, like once you start studying it. People have asked me that a lot, as far as like, oh, now that you know, singing was your major, or now that once you decided to become a music major, did that make music not fun? Because now you have to do music homework, now you have to do all these rehearsals, now you're getting graded to do music, doesn't feel less fun? And I never felt that way, but I can see how people would quickly feel that way, right? If it becomes analysis first, right, and it becomes stripped of this deep sense of trust and knowingness with music, right?
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that she uses that for like higher levels, like when you're actually analyzing music, but it would actually be, I'm just kind of tossing this out there, I randomly thought of it when you were talking, but like even to do that with like younger students who are not even really like students, but just like kids in elementary school taking like a music class, not even for an instrument, but to just actually lay down and like feel the music, you know, I feel like that'd be a good way to like get kids at like a younger age to really understand how music makes them feel before, you know, just jumping into like learning an instrument. Like, I think that would have been a fun exercise for me. I feel like when I was younger in a music class, I would have liked that, to just be able to sit with the music and see how it makes me feel and like really understand that, like just with my own head.
I really like when she points out, she has this whole section on like being a lesbian and why is she talking about music in this context, giving music a gender, right? In this piece, she makes music female. And so like, why would we personify music as a woman for her? Why would she personify music as a woman? It's because when you are a participant in what is deemed as a sexually deviant relationship, right, outside of the norm, right, so outside of a cis romance, outside of a cisgender heterosexual partnership between a man and a woman, there are different power dynamics at play, right? You don't have the man as the leader of the household and the woman as the support role. If it's two women, who's the butch lesbian? Who's the, you know, the feminine lesbian or whatever, right? Those barriers aren't really defined. And so she likes that relationship where there's a lot more give and take. There's a lot more play. And like you said, who's on top in this instance? Who's on top in that instance? Like, you don't know, and you guys get to switch and play and figure it out as you go, because there aren't these preconceived notions about what the man is supposed to do and what the woman is supposed to do. So I thought that was really interesting. She talks about her relationship with music being an escape from these stereotypes, quote, or is the whole relationship an escape for all parties from the power structure known as the gender system? That no one be in the position, worthless, powerless, marked woman, and no one be in the position, worthful, powerful, marked man. For me, the whole relationship is an escape. And that's what yes, like, it's just so good, because I really feel a lot of the same power dynamics, right, in the relationships that I've had, right, that are not only gendered, right, but they're also informed by race. The dynamics for me in relationships are, you know, often feel so incredibly claustrophobic that to retreat into my relationship with music feels so serene and particular, and it just fits, right, in a way that's really different from my romantic relationships with people. Like, sometimes it takes a lot of work to make them fit, and music and I don't have to work, like, it just fits. And that's what I really, really like about being a performer and being a scholar. It's something that has always fit, right? Since I was 8 or 9 years old, it was the thing that I never had to question. I never questioned whether I was going to be a music major. I never had to think about it. It was always just mine. We were always just each other's. So that's why a piece like this is so resonant for me, because it's like, yeah, I just feel strongly about music than I do about that, like, that more than most things. Like,
aww.
So, I know that that's weird, but it's also not, like, it's just my reality. And so, you know, can that be okay? Can we make space for there to be, not that there needs to be space, you know, like, in the LGBTQ community, that's like an M for musician, that's not what we're talking about here, like, but, you know, can I allow myself the space for that to be okay, and for that to be a more resonant identity to me than my sexual orientation? She says, quote, once you're outside of the heterosexual picture, there's so much wrong with the picture that it becomes relatively easier to just make up a new one. So again, that's the thing. Susan Kusick is so smart. That's the thing about heterosexual relationships. And from my experience, again, as a Black woman dating white men, Black men,
men.
Right? They're all a bit exhausting. You know, The patriarchy has no race, let me say that. And you know, it once you become aware of, oh, okay, so there are just things to being in a relationship with a man, there are compromises that I have to make, and you know, things that I'm gonna have to forgive over and over, just like being in relationships and friendships with white people, right? They're gonna say things to me that are gonna be upsetting sometimes, and they won't mean it, and it's not gonna be malicious, but that doesn't make it not upsetting, right? And those are things that I have to forgive, and that we have to work through, and that we have to talk about, right? And so I think once you're aware of all the ways, like, oh yeah, you know, I can, you know, keep dating men until I find quote unquote the right one. And he could very well be, you know, the right one and a good fit for me. But it's always just this idea of like, or I could just like retreat to music and we can just do our own thing. Like, we could just make up a new thing and no one else has to be involved, and that's like where I live and feel comfortable. I don't know. It sounds mighty nice to me. What's also interesting is she talks about this power triad, or this, what is it? She talks about this triad with power, pleasure, and intimacy, right? Like the ways in which we interact with each other, like in these intimate ways. She has this quote, "Are all musicians sexual deviants, in that we all negotiate in the power, pleasure, intimacy triad in ways that are outside the phallic economy of compulsory, genital, reproductive sexuality. Could that be why so many musicians are also deviants by more conventional definitions of sexuality and gender? That is only fitful participants in institutionalized heterosexuality." So this idea that, like, all the people in my class that read this that were uncomfortable, do they also, though, engage in this give and take with music, right? Is this necessary in order to be a good musician? And some people just don't call it sexuality, right? Like, but do we all participate in this role play with music, right? In this trading of power and of intimacy and of, right? Like, don't we get to know our music in the way that we know people? Like, don't we get to experience music and pleasure from music and give pleasure to music, like, and pleasure to the listener? Like, these are all ways in which we interact with music, but we just don't use the language of pleasure. Like, why not? Why does that language spook us?
Yeah, I mean, well, when I think of the word pleasure, I associate it to, you know, so that could be where it's coming from.
But there are a lot of different ways in which we experience pleasure, right? So I think it's also that we need to get comfortable with the concept of pleasure in general. Like, I read this book, it's called Please by Black Girl Bliss. I think the tagline is like self-care for women of color. And it's this idea of using like pleasure as self-care. Because the whole idea of self-care, right, has really kind of been taken over by like white women on Instagram, right? This idea of like, I'm gonna get my hair done, I'm gonna get my nails done, I'm gonna go shopping, right? These very like aesthetic ways of tending to oneself, of taking care of oneself. But again, they're aesthetic at best. So do they actually like bring you a lot of peace or rest or satisfaction, right? And, you know, these methods of like, yeah, I'm going to go get a facial or I'm going to go shopping and I'm going to do these things, that's not accessible. There are a lot of women, especially women of color, that don't have the funds to go and do that, right? So it kind of gives this message of like that self-care isn't really this accessible thing for everybody, right? Because you have to have the money and the time to do it. And this book kind of frames self-care in a way of like, okay, but what gives you pleasure, right? Outside of sexuality, right? Like, what brings you a lot of joy and like physical and emotional satisfaction? And that's going to be different for everybody, right? So it introduces this idea of like your self-care should be personal to you, right? Like what you do in order to take care of yourself and your body is going to be different than what someone else is going to do. So for me, I was in a book club when I read this. I was like, oh, you know, it's running. Like I just love running. And I feel so good when I run because my body was just meant to do it. And I love it. And running is not for everybody, right? Cardio is not for everybody. Just like weights are not for me. But, you know, like indulging in those things, peanut butter, right? Listen, I love peanut butter more than most things, right? Like I just have a relationship with peanut butter. So like when I eat peanut butter, just like taking a moment to really indulge and feel the pleasure of that experience, right? That's not a sexual thing. It's just, but it is a thing, right? That gives me a lot of personal satisfaction. So, you know, really figuring out those things or those moments, those places, those times of day, right? Like I'm a morning person. I love waking up and seeing the sunrise. I love being outside. I love going to Lake Michigan, right? Like finding places and moments and activities that you can go to for rest and relaxation rather than these like aesthetic things, right? Someone in the book club said, oh, I really feel that way. I really feel the sense of like inner peace when I'm like in the car and I'm driving, right? So like going for a drive and listening to great music, right? Like there's something about that in those moments that just like means so much to me, right? Like, and that was really cool to hear from her. Like, I don't like to drive personally, Lydia. I don't like driving, but like you might just really resonate with like those moments of being in the car and like, you know, going on a highway and like listening to great music and being with a friend and they're in the passenger seat and you're having a great time, right? So those moments, right, we can attribute the language of pleasure to them so that it doesn't become like a scary taboo thing, but it could just be a thing, right, that means a lot to you. Does that make sense? I feel like this whole podcast I've been like, does that make sense?
No, it does. Yeah, I'm thinking of the same way. Yeah, I think you word that perfectly. It makes perfect sense.
Do you have things that are popping to mind? Like, oh yeah, when I do this thing or when I go here, or, you know, when I eat this thing, it makes me really happy and I should make time to do it often.
Yeah. Okay. Chocolate. Going to the beach. Going for drives if it's in an area that I'm like well known of or I have a GPS going so I won't get myself lost and then I can focus on just singing in the car. Okay, this is gonna sound really, really weird, but it is something I've actually started doing over the summer. Please don't let Dr. Hesse know. But I've saved some, because you know we have class recordings. I've actually saved some of our class recordings about like certain stuff that we've talked about that I thought were really interesting. And sometimes when I just need like a break, instead of like going on YouTube to watch YouTube videos, I watch back those certain parts of our class. Like, because I saved a few. It's not just like the same few that I'm looking at, but I saved a few of them. That's something I've started doing recently. Like, it's so weird, but like I find it really relaxing and it almost brings me back to like the safe space of being in class with like a group of people, you know, and like doing theory, which I love. So it's that combination too that I really like.
Listeners, that's the
don't
thing.
Tell him.
Emily caught it. She's got the bug. Okay. Oh my God. That is the moment where Dr. Kerr read that paper and he was like, whoa, there's something going on here. And Emily's got it, right? Like that idea of like, oh, when I need like a moment to recuperate, I'm gonna go to theory, right? I feel that too. And I like don't know when that started or why that why I'm like that, but I'm just like that. That like I get so much pleasure from the process of analysis. And it sounds like you also experienced just a lot of warm, fuzzy, great feelings from like, let me just retreat into doing some oral skills right now. And that's going to be fun for me. And that's going to be relaxing for me. And that's where I go after like a stressful day or after like, you know, after, you know, like that, the idea that like, in the same way that we would sometimes regard our partners as our safe place, right? That music is our safe place, and that analysis, like music analysis specifically, as a safe space, right? Like what is going on with us? What?
Yeah. We're like, strange people. I can't even explain my own self.
Listeners are like, let's, you know, we're going to start a GoFundMe for their like therapy fund because there's something. Okay. I would love to know, Emily, I have a question for you.
Oh, geez. There's,
there's a moment where she talks about, you know, this piece that she heard on the radio when she was a child, and it gave her this like, you know, again, like guttural, visceral, bodily response where she was like dancing, and it just like brought her so much joy and pleasure throughout her whole body. And she heard it again as an adult and felt the same rush of pleasure. Other pieces where, you know, the first time you heard it, you're like, oh,
so many. Literally so many. You know what, I still haven't done it, and I keep wanting to do it. I've contemplated on making just like a document of like songs that I, because there's been so many different genres of songs I've listened to, and like making a document where I have those certain songs and the experience that like they're linked to, like the time in my life, and then like to go back to those if I want to like feel those moments again, because there are so many. Like when I just happen to hear like certain songs just like on Instagram going through stuff, or even on like Facebook, that will come up a bit, and part of me like wants to like do that just to, because when I do hear it, like it reminds me exactly of the situation and exactly the time in my life. I could literally like vision the place I was when I first heard it. So yeah, I can't even just like name one song, just so many that even aren't classical music. Like I know we're kind of talking about that, but that wasn't a part of my life when I was like 12 and under. So it's mostly like pop music or any, there's a lot of genres of music that I'm thinking about that like define like certain what? Parts
name,
of my life.
Names. The listeners are dying to know. They're dying to like get a link to this Google Drive where you put in all your songs. Names.
I'm trying to think of ones on the spot. Okay. It's gonna make me cry. I don't even know who's the writer of this. Do You Remember by, what's his name? Hold on, give me a second.
Is it gonna be the song? Do You Remember?
Wait. No, no, that's not that.
Earth, Wind, and Fire, right?
No, wait. I found it. Hold on. Who's this person? Okay. Oh, Jay Sean. Do You Remember? It was actually a song that my brother.
Wow. Like the to. Do You Remember?
Remember?
Oh my god. Whoa, I haven't heard that song in like, how old is that song, like 10 years?
Jeez, yeah,
it's been a while. No,
2009. Whoa. Oh my gosh.
Oh, put me in the grave now. Oh my goodness. That's crazy. Yeah,
that's the first one that came to the top of my head.
Really, what an interesting choice. Wow. Come back in a couple years, yes. Listeners. That's going to be Emily's dissertation on Jay Sean.
I know you never, oh my gosh, you never hear me talk about music that is not like classical music. So this is so weird for me to like talk about pieces of music.
Wow. I'm shook. We should have an episode where we talk about like our favorite music that's like not classical music. That's a good episode. We'll do that.
Oh geez. I don't talk about that with like anyone. So that would be so interesting.
Well, we're about to talk about it with you, listeners. We'll have a whole episode next season where we talk about music outside of classical music. Oh yeah. You're gonna find out about my Chemical Romance phase and my Fleet Foxes phase, and it's gonna get crazy. Anyway, let's see. I guess some songs for me. Let's see. Because I tried to think back to, you know, I had a very similar moment to what Cusick is describing, you know, when I was 8 or whatever, and that orchestra came to my school to play. And I don't remember what they played, but I had a very similar moment of like, whoa, like just like the pleasure washing over me and me being like, that's what I'm going to do with my life. And I don't remember what that was, but I remember pretty early in like middle school and high school, really loving Egmont Overture, Beethoven. It's funny because I always come for Beethoven. And I'm always like, oh, can we stop talking about Beethoven and genius? But I do really love that piece. So see, listener, they can coexist. I can both roast Beethoven and also love him. It's both, okay? But, you know, I remember loving that piece and loving to play that piece. I played that at regionals one year. Loved it. Anything else? Lots of Amy Beach's music and lots of Hugo Wolf's music. Oh, wow. Just gives me those feelings of like, oh my gosh, this is the best thing. Outro time. Thank you so much, listeners, for tuning into the Theory Club. I know this has been, you know, an intense episode for all of us. You need to drink some water. You do. You need to take a moment, take a seat, drink some water, because, you know, we talked about a lot. I know you're probably feeling a little, got a little wild, but we've done it. So thank you so much for listening. If you want to get in touch with us, you can email us at thetheoryclubpodcast@gmail.com. If you're thinking, wow, this episode, they didn't have a guest, because it should have been me. That should be me holding your hand. You're like, wow, I should have been the guest. You can send us an email, you know, let's talk about it. Let's get you on the pod. Send us the music you want us to listen to, the things you want us to read. We can do that. We can incorporate it into our next season. So thank you again for listening, for your continued support. Continue to engage with us on the Instagram and on the Facebook group. And other than that, we hope you have a great Friday and a great weekend. And we will see you next time. Bye.
Bye.
Wow, listeners, there are so many juicy tidbits that I have to cut out of the podcast. I'm going to put this mid-podcast so that you know that we have disclosed some juicy details that I'm not going to share with y'all, because, again, the internet is a hellhole. I will not let me not broadcast what Emily just said. But, you know, it's kosher. You know, we're a family-friendly podcast. We're just, you know, not going to put all of our personal details on the internet. Anyway,
Yeah, I won't talk about this with my friends, but I'll talk about it on a podcast where anyone can listen to it.